Welcome to this week's edition of World Crisis Radio. This is Webster Tarpley speaking to you from Washington, D.C., just back from a jaunt to New York City for the opening of the United Nations General Assembly and the big diplomacy around the Obama-Putin summit. So we are back with a program which is full of news. Excuse me. Full of news, and that would be coming up now in the first segment. But first, let me invite you to another event, and this is here in Washington, D.C. It's on Monday evening, October 5th, this coming Monday, at the National Press Club. I am going to be the guest of the Capitol Hill Civil War Roundtable. Capitol Hill Civil War Roundtable. And the title that they've given this is Webster Tarpley Discusses the Russian Navy and the Civil War. So this is the question of the Russian fleets. Now, if you've already seen my lecture on the Russian fleets, come anyway, because this one is going to be complete with the best slideshow I can put together, and I think you'll be well served if you attend. So this will be at the National Press Club, Monday, October 5th at 5:30 p.m. Now, 5:30 p.m. is if you want to take part in the dinner, including me and the chance to discuss this topic, but also others, right, with the Capitol Hill Civil War Roundtable, of course, permitting. So I want to thank the Capitol Hill Civil War Roundtable. So this will be in the National Press Club, up way up on the 14th floor. And the actual event, I believe, is at 7 p.m. But do come early. Do come between 6:30 and 7 at least. And then that will allow you to take part in this dinner conversation or post-dinner conversation. If you want the dinner, do come at 5:30 p.m. Monday, October 5th, National Press Club in Washington, D.C. And I'll repeat that. I'll have that up on Twitter in particular. Now, this has been an epic week. It is in some ways the end of an era. The certitudes of the past 25 years of the unipolar world are rapidly dissolving all around us. Don't waste your time lamenting the passing of this unipolar era. It has not been good. And let's start, not good for the people of the United States by any stretch of the imagination. This was the era of reactionary politics, declining standards of living, cultural barbarism verging on bestialization, a horrible time, an eclipse of reason and an eclipse of the human personality, a crisis of the human personality up and down the line. Indeed, a terrible time. So we have, and I'll try to go into some historical background about this, the self-assertion of the Russian Federation, leading a coalition, right? You can call the coalition the BRICS coalition, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. You can think of it as the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, or you can think of it also as the Russian state system, because you have to think about countries like Belarus and Donetsk and Lugansk and these places. That's all part of a Russian state system, which has been rebuilt. I say, first of all, the United States has absolutely nothing to fear from this. It's all beneficial, provided we can get rid of some of the lunatics that have been inhabiting the executive branch. As you know, we of the Tax Wall Street Party are taking credit big time for the ouster of ISIS Czar John Allen. We didn't represent the big battalions, but we represented the catalyst and the coordination of the big battalions to get together on a project. Allen out by the end of the summer. And sure enough, with one or two days to spare in the summer of 2015, Allen was out on his ear, fired. And he is now being followed by a couple of other hangers-on. I'm looking here at Politico. Politico, the political compendium. And this is from the 29th of September, just a couple of days ago. Pentagon's top Russian official resigns. The Pentagon top official overseeing military relations with Russia and Ukraine is resigning amid the ongoing debate within the Obama administration over how to respond to Russian moves in Syria and Ukraine. This is Evelyn Farkas, F-A-R-K-A-S, Evelyn Farkas, Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia, leaving at the end of November after 5 years in office at the State Department. And the word on here is she has advised three secretaries of defense, Gates, Panetta, and now Ash Carter, advised three secretaries of defense on Russian policy, providing steady counsel on how the U.S. should respond to Russia's aggressive actions. Blah, blah, blah. She got $244 million in support for Ukraine, and she brought fresh thinking to Southeast Europe. She supported Montenegro in joining NATO. She wanted to have cooperation with Georgia and increasing multilateral cooperation with the three Caucasus nations. Now, this looks like a neocon firebrand to me. This looks like a an operative, somebody who was sitting at a desk and killing people at a distance and wrecking the U.S. position in the world. So the question is, how much lethal aid for the Ukrainian fascist regime? Ash Carter, we're told, is open to providing lethal aid to Ukraine. How dare he say this if that's not the administration policy? Fire him right away if he wants to be a solo player going off the reservation. The president has constrained the U.S. response. Thank God. Constrain it more, Obama. You get the idea. Hagel would have been another guy she worked for. So she's out. That can only be good. Now, remember, we want Victoria Nuland out. Why don't we have a mass exodus of failed officials? The debacle of Syria. We're told now that the U.S. has nine, count them, nine Pentagon-funded moderate terrorist rebels. Boy, if the Russians can find nine moderate terrorist rebels, that's a needle in a haystack. Those Russians must have some kind of GPS or guidance system if they can find nine terrorist rebels. Now, of course, the claim coming from Walnuts McCain and others is that the Russians have bombed the moderate terrorist rebels, his friends, he claims, that are funded by the Pentagon. So, I'm sorry, funded by the CIA. The Pentagon-funded ones are nine. The CIA ones, where they don't do any vetting, those are more numerous. And those are getting clobbered, of course, because they're in a revolving door. They're in the same revolving door with the ISIS killers. So, right now we've got a race. And my zinger on this is to the Pentagon. If you don't keep pace, you will lose face. Pentagon, get in there and bomb ISIS, right? You're so great. You got the greatest military. Tell us, show us, show us. Don't let the Russians hog all the glory. Get in there and make your own contribution, too. Let's have a peace race. Who can clobber ISIS? Because that's what we need. The Russian bombing looks very capable. We're now in the third day of the bombing. It was Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. Good results. 12 targets now, including Raqqa, the capital. And we've got, however, an absurd piece of idiot diplomacy. Six countries, including the unfortunate Madame Merkel, say stop doing it. We'll be back in just a minute with this on World Crisis Radio. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Webster Tarpley here in Washington, D.C. So, the Russian Federation is doing an effective job. This is serious bombing now. These are not the pinpricks and phony war appeasement strategies imposed by now departing ISIS czar Allen. This is serious bombing. And then we've got the Western whiners who were not strong enough to oust Allen for 12 months. Now it seems to be done. So we've got the United, this, the countries that are saying to the Russian Federation, stop doing it. United States, United Kingdom, Federal Republic of Germany, France, Turkey, Qatar, and Saudi. They all say, stop, stop. You might hurt those terrorist rebels. Those are moderate terrorist rebels. The official U.S. position comes down to saying, you can bomb ISIS, but you can't bomb Al-Qaeda. Let's send a letter to all of the 3,000 9/11 families and show them that the current bombing policy does not allow anybody from Al-Qaeda to get clobbered. And instead, that is what has to happen. So Walnuts McCain, the man who cavorts with cannibals, caliphs, and kidnappers, as he did, arrest McCain for ISIS. Once again, we're back to the same slogan. By the way, McCain now has a primary opponent. He might be in trouble for next year. This is where reactionaries, evil people, can do good by opposing McCain. So he's complaining about that. The CIA unvetted rebels exist cheek by jowl with the ISIS people and the Al-Qaeda people. So they're simply inseparable. So this is a bunch of malarkey, and it gets very close, once again, to public support for terrorism. That the U.S. is going to say our foreign policy is based on ISIS and Al-Qaeda, which unfortunately has to some degree been the case. Now, the Russians, what are they doing? It's very obvious. You have got to stabilize Assad first. The main bulwark protecting the world from the ISIS butchers and madmen is the Syrian Arab Army. And I've learned to respect them. As I think I mentioned a couple of times, I visited a military hospital in Damascus in November of 2011. I was impressed by the bravery, by the sense of duty of the wounded soldiers that I had there. And I told every one of them, to the extent that I could, you are in the front line of civilization. And there are at least some people in the Western world who understand your sacrifice and who thank you for it and are grateful, because you're the front line against civilization, the point where civilization collides with barbarism. So you're in the front line. So what Russia has been doing, quite obviously, is to bomb the most advanced rebel positions, not really caring whether it's ISIS or Al-Qaeda or Nusra or this phantomatic Free Syrian Army, or whether it's one of the 150 to 200 other groupings of lunatics. Remember, the principle for Syria is this. The opposition is in parliament. There are opposition deputies in there. They're in there. So they can, if you want to oppose Assad, you can do it. When I went to Homs, the governor of Homs had a communist and a wealthy woman, and they represented different opposition groups, and we talked to them, and that was the opposition then and now. A lot of opposition groups have realized the gaping abyss below them if they get caught up into ISIS, so they've come back to the parliament. Anybody out in the countryside or in a city with armed opposition is a terrorist. It's just that simple. If you've got a Kalashnikov out in the slums or the countryside, you're a terrorist, and that makes you fair game. So Russia bombing the advanced rebel positions, protecting Assad. If there's any question of the collapse of Assad, the whole thing is over. You've got to have a ground force. Remember, the bombing works best when you've got ISIS bunched up against the Syrian Arab Army or the Kurds or Hezbollah or Iran. And we're hearing now that there will be a joint effort. It's even possible that China could join in it. This would make the world consensus overwhelming. The United States simply cannot go on with a foreign policy based on supporting terrorist groups. It's just that simple. It's got to end. And the people who are arguing for this are lunatics, and they've got to be fired. And that's Nuland and Power and quite a few others. I forgot to say Ambassador McGurk, the scurrilous what can we say, a personality out of Boccaccio's Decameron. This McGurk has been calling himself ambassador when he really doesn't have a permanent title. So he's a fraud. Don't let McGurk take over Allen's job. He'll simply continue the wreckage wrought by Allen. Now, There's a conference going on today in Paris. It's a summit. It is Germany with Merkel, France with Hollande, Putin for the Russian Federation, and Poroshenko for Ukraine. This is billed as a Ukraine conference, but now the linkage between Syria and Ukraine is overwhelming because you've got to get Russian help into Syria to destroy ISIS, stop the civil war. Therefore, you've got to end the economic sanctions on Russia, end the economic sanctions on Syria, and then proceed to cooperate, open diplomatic relations with Assad. Merkel is now saying she needs Russia to solve the Syrian question. Merkel has now also said that Germany wants to cooperate with Assad. So cooperate, open your embassy, send weapons to Assad, help Assad, arrest the various Free Syrian Army terrorists on German territory while you still have a chance. One speculation, of course, is that the CIA response to all this is that the CIA will try to strike in southern Russia, be it Chechnya, be it these other border areas in the Caucasus, Transcaucasus, North Caucasus, or, as we've seen, some city in southern Russia or something of this kind. In other words, to act this out. The group meeting in Paris is officially the continuation of Minsk II, to oversee the fulfillment of the Minsk II accords, which, on the whole, have been successful. So this is going on today. We have to remember, right, not all rebels are supplied through Turkey. We have other groups of rebels in southern Syria. Indeed, this is where the troubles began, that are supplied through Jordan. So don't forget Jordan. And the outlook of Jordan is not so different from the outlook of the Saudi monarchy, right, based on tribes in Jordan. Now, the other thing to remember, there never was a peaceful phase. For the 99 millionth time, there never was this halcyon days. We're hearing about this on National Pentagon Radio this morning, NPR, the Diane Rehm Show, International Review. There never was a peaceful phase. The rebels were shooting from the first day, from the word go, going back to 1982. Back a minute. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Webster Tarpley here in Washington. It's the afternoon of October 2nd, 2015. And, of course, we just come from our unique Welcome Putin demonstration. The Tax Wall Street Party, United Front Against Austerity, was the only organization in North America to stage a Welcome Putin greeting in Dag Hammarskjöld Plaza near the United Nations. We want to thank the Belarusian television for being there. We want to thank Press TV of Iran for being there. And a couple of people associated with Russia today, but we also deplore the incomprehensible editorial policy of Russia Today that ignored, in effect, on their air, the only pro-Putin demonstration. What is wrong with that policy? Or better, you should ask what's right with it, because it's just incomprehensible. Lots of time for Rand and Ron and Assange and Snowden, but not enough time for people who actually have some positive idea of Russia. Anyway, that will not stop us. We will simply escalate until some of these people hopefully see the light. Now, at the United Nations, a lot of stuff. Abu Abbas, Abu Mazen of the Palestinian Authority, has said that he will no longer respect the Oslo Accords of the early 1990s, right? There was that bright dawn of post-Cold War negotiations, but it's all fallen through because of people like Netanyahu, and because of the assassination of Rabin, this has not delivered its promise, needless to say. So Abu Abbas, attempting to keep attention focused on the Palestinians, as it certainly deserves to be. Netanyahu's histrionics have now reached the new all-time low. His impudence, but his desperation, right? The pathos and creepy quality, the 45-second interval glaring at the entire world shows, I think, a political desperado who is not long for power. And remember, who subsidizes those histrionic antics and that impudence is the American taxpayer. You're paying for him to put on that show. So better this guy should go into spending more time with his family. Lavrov and Kerry seem to be continuing some kind of dialogue, right? Notice we're not featuring Skull and Bones Kerry on our immediate ouster list, along with Kaplan and Allen and Newland and Samantha Power. But this is conditional on Kerry being reasonable. Joubert, the Saudi foreign minister, the guy who used to be here in Washington, right? They had sympathy gags for him. There were supposedly plots against him that were actually manufactured by the U.S. intelligence community to win him a little sympathy. Joubert says that with the Russian presence in Syria, a red line has been crossed. And then the journalist said, well, what are you going to do about it, Saudi? And he said, you'll see, right? Stay tuned. You will see. That's another one. There's another group that's ready to fight to the last American. Boy, they are going to be out there and aggressive and so forth. Also domestically now, people are having a hard time adjusting to the new realities. We have Miliband of one of the international charity organizations and Hillary Clinton candidate saying it's time to go back to a no-fly zone. Well, guess what? The Russian forces in Syria have essentially constructed a kind of a dome, a bubble over Syria. And the idea that the Israelis or the U.S. could go in there without provoking a major armed clash, that idea is passé. There would be a major armed clash, and God knows what would turn out as the consequence of that. So we're going to decline that. We don't want to know what the result would be. Instead, it's time to set up the coordination, right? There is a danger that with the U.S. and France and Russia and Britain and Syria and others, for what we know, Gulf states might be there too. We just don't know. In bombing Syria, bombing ISIS and so forth, that could lead to complications. Now, there is a coordination, we're told. We're told that there's a coordination in Baghdad. There's a kind of a committee that meets there, or a kind of a continuous consultation process. And that would be Iraq, Syria, Iran, and Russia. So they're coordinating. Why doesn't the U.S., why don't the British, French, and U.S. join that coordination so that you can actually conduct a war on terror? What's illegitimate? If Nusra is threatening to overthrow the Assad regime, which I don't believe, but if they were, it would make a whole lot of sense. It would be imperative to bomb the heck out of Nusra, because you've got to keep the Syrian Arab army in the field, well-stocked, good morale, and fighting qualities, because they have all this. They will defend themselves, right? This is not the Afghan army. It's not the Iraq army. This is the Syrian one, and they fight. So let's start cooperating. Now, we're told, what's the mood in the Pentagon? We're told, first of all, that a lot of U.S. military officers are defeatist. They say, oh, gosh, we don't even know how to defeat ISIS. I'll tell you how to defeat ISIS. 1,000 bomber raid in a day. You could do that, right? Maybe you couldn't put 1,000 in the air all at once like you did at the beginning of the first Gulf War in 1991. 1,000 bomber raid, clobber ISIS, wipe them out. This can be done. Force Turkey to close the border. And cooperate with Russia. Cooperate with Assad. Arm Assad. Dump the Free Syrian Army, right? Those guys are lounge lizards in the four-star hotels of the Middle East. So we're told that there's defeatism. I think that defeatism is a pose, that this is simply their way of saying, we're appeasers. We believe in the phony war. You got to get rid of officers that are sympathetic to Petraeus and Allen and this Breedlove, this guy. Breedlove is another person on the list of those who should be spending more time with their families. Now, we're also told that in the Pentagon and to some degree in the White House, there are people who are hoping that Putin will find a quagmire. Well, you can see he put his base in the middle of the Alawites, so no terrorists are going to have an easy time getting to the Russian base. And other than that, he's going to use air power, and the ground forces will once again be Syrian, Hezbollah, Iranian, Iraqi. Iraq has invited Russia to bomb ISIS in Iraq because the Allen policy of phony war and appeasement has been so wretched, so impotent and pathetic that the Iraqis can see that the U.S. is not helping them in the way the U.S. obviously could. The great military establishment that rolled over Saddam Hussein in 6 weeks and all the rest of this stuff is now checkmated by a rabble of ragtag psychotic killers. And again, they're not even the JV. They're the intramural teams. They're a big nothing. National Pentagon Radio is also very unhappy with General Sisi. And they are really distorting the facts about this. Inside the U.S., we've got a slow process of adjusting opinions to the new realities. Realistic thinking is creeping into the nation. They have an article about how to end the Syrian civil war, which is an extremely tentative and cautious opening to Assad. Well, we have to tell the Europeans, right, Merkel and company, scream louder. Make that that objection known. And please, Merkel, at least Merkel, don't sign a document saying that Russia should stop bombing the ISIS people. What is that? Or any terrorist rebel you find. It's just crazy. But anyway, things are moving, and you can already see the outlines of a new world, a bipolar world. And it's going to be better. Trust me, it's going to be better. Back in a minute on World Crisis Radio. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. And now we're keeping up, as always, with the Greek situation, so full of lessons for what to do and what not to do. So we're very happy to be joined by our fine correspondent in Athens, and that is Michael Chiotinis. So we got to get an update about what is happening now as this the new government and the new ministries actually begin functioning. So, Michael, you are on the ground. Tell us what's important.
Yes, hello. There's an article today in today's edition of Avgi, the newspaper that is friendly to the Syriza party. I found it's very interesting because I read it an hour ago. With the title, The Vital Lie, quote-unquote, Vital Lie. It has the form, not exactly of a cultural review, rather some philosophical and ideological thoughts about a well-known play from the 1880s called The Wild Duck by Ibsen, Henrik Ibsen, the Norwegian playwright. The main theme of the article is to challenge the mainstream reading of the play, which is that sometimes reality is unbearable and you need to have a vital lie to go on living. It concludes arguing that the reverse is the case, that for a radical like Ibsen, the vital lie is only useful for people and societies that don't expect anything good to come in the future. So they passively and uncomplainingly accept their fate. This article, I'm telling you this because it's quite enigmatic for me, precisely because it's written effectively in the official newspaper of Syriza. Now, is the author trying to suggest that Syriza is offering vital lies, namely that this latest deal has any chance of working, or that Syriza really can't bring something good following the mandates of the Troika? Or even the biggest lie of all, that Greece's EU partners will fulfill the promised debt restructuring, which is already debt restructuring, not a haircut. Or is this a critique of the society's passiveness and the defense of strategic path that Tsipras has chosen? I don't know. All I know is that the signing of the new deal a week after 62% of Greeks had rejected a new memorandum through a referendum, is the reason of this passiveness. Now, we had there are still people in Syriza, MPs, who actually followed Tsipras and didn't go to the Popular Unity Party, who believe the theory that Tsipras was blackmailed and had to give in to the blackmail because he had no other plans ready for implementation. These people voted for the bailout deal, but we may yet see some of them not willing to vote for particular legislation. So we have some of the MPs that may yet deny voting for certain austerity legislation. And we have the people that voted for Syriza. They don't really expect the deal to be implemented, or they expect Tsipras to move the burden on the rich. Well, that's not going to happen, in my view, because the Troika is not interested in money. They're interested in imposing a specific social model. But anyway, we have two interesting things coming up. The Portuguese election, actually, the day after tomorrow.
Good.
And the polling shows that not a particular change of status quo is possible. And the Spanish election.
But we know, we learned from Greece, don't believe the polls. And don't, you know, there's always the red shift. So we don't believe it, right?
Yeah, okay. But they show a fairly great lead. Anyway, and we have polling about the Spanish election of December 20th showing exactly the same thing. There's no visible trend about a shift of the status quo in other southern economies being attacked in this way of Greece. We had also members of the Popular Unity Party, the pro-Grexit party, announcing a detailed plan. This is by Professor Lapavitsas and Heiner Flasbeck. Exactly, Heiner Flasbeck, a German politician and economist. And that's actually, our listeners can find it in on theathensrepublic.com. I've published it there. We had some Popular Unity members, former ministers, actually, bullied, intimidated. They were in Ukraine. They were at the Odisha region that's governed by none other than Mikhail Saakashvili. And they were intimidated, chased, and bullied by paramilitary groups, right-wing fascists. And we had a very interesting situation there. They fortunately, they're back. And they are safe. This is it. Now,
just a couple of things. This Flasbeck, looking him up, right? So he's somebody who worked at UNCTAD, right? UNCTAD was considered one of the more radical parts of the United Nations bureaucracy. So he was at UNCTAD Geneva, right? United Nations Conference on Trade and Development. So he was there for a good 10 years. But the problem with him is his theories seem to be based on two ideas. One, he wants to support Schumpeter, this German origin economist. And you remember the idea with Schumpeter is creative destruction, right? Let the depression burn itself out, right? Let it play itself out, right? It's actually close to the Austrian or libertarian view. But at the same time, he's got Wilhelm Lautenbach. And Lautenbach is the guy that we've talked about here. Lautenbach is the guy who says, you don't let the depression burn itself out. You fight the depression. You launch a 2 billion mark, Reichsmark proposal in those days. And you start building the Autobahn and you build the telephone system and railroads and other things. You soak up a whole bunch of unemployment. And you cut Hitler off at the knees, so the Nazis might not have made it. So the big question with Flasbeck is, are we going to get the Schumpeter side of him with creative destruction? I hope not. Or are we going to get the Lautenbach side? So the Lautenbach is again, what I think listeners of the program know, right? That's pretty much what I also represent, right? W.S. Wojtynski German trade union plan, right? The one from the trade union.
Yeah, presented right? at the Friedrich Society Club.
Yeah, the Friedrich List Society is the Lautenbach side, and then the Wojtynski Tarnow Bada WTB, right? That's the trade union one, and they agreed, and that would have been the basis for avoiding Hitler. Except this windbag Hilferding said, no, we can't do that because it violates Marxism, and it was actually because Hilferding was British and in league with Brüning, the austerity king. So that's that.
No, I think we have the positive part because they're talking about technology and production, and all I see is positive things, actually. Professor Lapavitsas has worked in Argentina, about China. He has these particular models of industrial development and growth and technological, cutting-edge technology. So I think we're going to get something positive from this, but we must start.
And there we are. So thank you, Michael. We'll see you next week.
Thank you very much.
And I'm going to say a few words about Ibsen here in the next segment. Back in a minute. Welcome back to hour two of the World Crisis Radio. Webster Tarpley speaking from Washington, D.C. on this afternoon of Friday, the 2nd of October. We're now in the fourth quarter, and let me now repeat my cordial invitation to anybody who is in the Washington, D.C. area or can get here. Please come to the National Press Club on Monday evening, Monday, October 5th at 5:30 p.m. for the dinner party and 7 o'clock for the talk. This is going to be an illustrated version with slides, and I hope there'll be good slides. I'm working on it, concerning the contribution of the Russian fleets to the victory of Lincoln and the Union in the Civil War, preventing the snakes of Henry Gladstone and the rest of them, Lord Palmerston, Lord John Russell, and Louis Napoleon Bonaparte, from intervening on the side of the slaveholding Confederacy. So that's going to be the Capitol Hill Civil War Roundtable sponsor in the National Press Club, top of the building, right? Top 14th floor, the club part. And that's the Monday, October 5th, 5:30 p.m. for the dinner, 7 p.m. for the actual talk. Please come early. Now, concerning Ibsen, right, the wild duck, this is the story, right? Is it a good idea to give somebody a myth about himself so that he can keep going? So it's a conversation between two guys, Gregers and Relling. And there's a third guy that they're discussing, a guy called Hjalmar Molvik. And Relling has said to Molvik, you know, you're really a demon. And the question is, you know, it doesn't have anything to do with anything. It's just a way for the guy to make some myth about himself so that he can keep going. And Relling, of course, is a total cynic. And Relling says, you know, you should always bear in mind that ideals are not really anything that counts. We ought to use the national word or slogan, Norway, lies, he says. The other guy says, aren't these the same thing? Yes, they are. Gregers then says, look, I'm going to liberate this poor Molvik from your clutches. And Relling, this is the key quote, Relling then says, that would be the worst thing that could happen to our friend Molvik, because if you take away from the average man his vital lie, at the same time, you're going to take away his happiness and his sense of life. So it's the idea, you've heard this as a cliche, right? That if you take away people's illusions, you leave them with absolutely nothing. So we naturally stand in reality. And the advice for Greece is stop with the chauvinism, organized internationally, right? You can't expect it to, you know, you don't have a magic wand, but do something, you know, ally with that Portuguese party, ally with the Spanish party, especially if they get rid of now the failed leadership of Pablo Iglesias, who has done very poorly in Catalonia, and also start an international consultation, right? There will be this this Plan B, the International Plan B Conference. There was an event earlier this month, I guess, in Paris with Mélenchon for the French Le Parti de Gauche, La Fontaine for Die Linke, the left of Germany, Fassina of one of the Italian parties, and Varoufakis. Okay, fine. So the Tax Wall Street Party is highly interested. By the way, if people find out more about that, please send me the information. Go to the Speakers Bureau part of Tarpley.net, and there's a text box. Put it in there, and I will certainly thank you for it, because we're highly interested in intervening. Now, let's see if we conclude the international section. I guess we have. So now look, some stuff on the domestic front. We're being asked about the Trump tax plan. Well, trumped up is the only way to describe the Trump tax plan. It's trickle-down economics. How many times are you going to fall for this from a reactionary Republican demagogue, in this case a fascist Republican demagogue? Let's have tax cuts for the rich. And remember, as soon as they start talking about percentages, forget it. The way to do tax reform is to increase the standard deduction and the personal exemptions. Increase those and you'll have tax reform from the bottom up, helping working families. Not percentages where the, for example, according to Trump, the top rate goes from 40% almost to 25%. The corporate income tax goes from 35 to 15, lowering the tax on speculation. The estate tax, right? The oligarch tax, as I call it, right? The ill-gotten loot tax is eliminated. So this is a gift to parasitic millionaires, zombie bankers, hedge fund hyenas, and other parasites. We want the 1% Wall Street sales tax. He doesn't seem to have that in there. And of course, the argument is, oh, if you say that the deficit will grow, and of course the experts do, the accountants, not even experts, but they would say that the deficit would grow enormously, which again, if you were getting something for it, if you were making capital investments, that would be something you could at least argue. We want to do it through a combination of the 1% Wall Street sales tax and seizing the Federal Reserve, forcing them to cough up $6 trillion initial tranche of cheap 0% long-term U.S. credit for infrastructure and education to rebuild the entire physical plant. Boy, if you've been in the New York City subways lately, that $5 trillion for infrastructure is long overdue. So the deficit would balloon, and again, for no benefit, right? It would simply do what it did under Reagan, right? And the way Reagan responded was by increasing, by gouging it out of Social Security with the help of Greenspan. So, not good. This is typical Republican economics. It's trickle down. We noticed that he's gotten the endorsement of Grover Norquist. Now, this is one of the biggest political harlots in the Capitol, right? This is the guy with the Wednesday meeting to plot overall reactionary strategy. Maybe that Wednesday meeting of Grover Norquist is not everything it used to be, but it's still the kiss of death as far as anybody with a brain. And notice they say, oh, your predictions of the deficit growing, that's based on static scoring. We got to have dynamic scoring, and that's all based on the idea if you lower the tax rate, then the economic activity increases so that the net receipts, tax revenue, goes up. Sorry, it hasn't worked. It didn't work under Reagan, and it won't work. Now, we hear a lot now about the several trillion dollars that U.S. corporations have stashed overseas. And as usual with Trump and other reactionaries, or fascists in this case, we're told that the United States government has to make a sacrifice. It has to offer them a special deal to get, to coax them, to persuade them to bring back that overseas loot and submit it to the U.S. Treasury and the U.S. tax system. Well, that's not the way we see it at the Tax Wall Street Party. We say, focus their minds and encourage them with a tax that's applied here and now, saying if you stash money overseas, you might as well kiss 50% of it or something along those lines. Goodbye. And then you'll see them eagerly lining up to pay 35% normal corporate income. Hit them, threaten them with a penalty. We'll be back in a minute. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Webster Tarpley here in Washington, D.C. So the Trump tax plan, it's also, it's demagogic, right? He's got the capital gains rate for Trump is going to be 15% for people in the second highest tax bracket. So he's got everything calibrated so that he's a couple of percentage points more reactionary, more fascistoid than Jebby. So you can see what it is. It's a purely demagogic performance. Who knows what factors convinced Grover Norquist, right? Grover Norquist, obviously, always looking for contributions to keep his scurrilous operation afoot. So the other interesting one in terms of policy, remember Elizabeth Warren back in the spring of 2013, May, just as the academic year was ending, unfortunately. Remember, she proposed a 0.75 interest rate on 1 year of new federal student loans, and that would be come out of the discount window of the Federal Reserve so that the student could get the same rate that a zombie banker could get. And since we are not sectarian at all, we immediately launched a campaign in support of that proposal, the 0.75, also because the interest rate would have been the lowest available. Naturally, we would have argued for a 0% rate out of the Maiden Lane credit facility, say, something like that at the Federal Reserve. But still, 0.75 is better than 3, 4, or 10. And at the same time, we were encouraged to see somebody in the Democratic Party proposing to coerce, to direct, to force, to oblige the Federal Reserve to serve the public interest and not just a clique of zombie bankers meeting in an oak panel boardroom. The problem was, of course, that poor Elizabeth Warren, I guess betraying her mushhead roots, immediately dropped the proposal. Why did she drop the proposal? Well, as we said, the Democratic Party put the heat on her. And we're now finding that the way that this happened was a guy called Robert Litan, L-I-T-A-N, and he put out a, I guess, an interview. He posed as an official of the Brookings Institution. He overdid his title and his authorization, I guess. Strobe Talbot, remember him, Clinton's old friend, Strobe Light, is the current head of the Brookings Institution, who is trying to defend Litan, because Elizabeth Warren said that Robert Litan was editorially compromised in his attack on her tax. And you'll remember how nasty the Brookings Institution was, saying, you know, this is a proposal that deserves to be forgotten and spat upon and thrown in the garbage and flushed down the toilet. They were beside themselves, because it really was an interesting breakthrough. But Elizabeth Warren simply didn't have the guts to keep going. And now she puts out a thing blaming Robert Litan, then of the Capital. His research was sponsored by the so-called Capital Group, obviously a group of investors, I guess we can say. So that's Elizabeth Warren complaining. Well, why didn't you keep fighting there, Liz? Why didn't you show us what a fighter you were? They come after you and you fold and you cave. That's not inspiring at all. We're also told now that Secretary of Education Arnie Duncan is going to be leaving. He's undoubtedly got a lucrative offer from some privatized charter school or privatized education operation, because that's what he's been trying to do, wrecking the Chicago Teachers Union and others, taking advantage of the American Federation of Teachers and so forth. So that's deplorable. Now, concerning COINTELPRO stalking, one of our constant themes here, right? We're trying to spread awareness that the old COINTELPRO 1.0 has now been surpassed by COINTELPRO stalking 2.0. And the difference is the old method, 1.0, was fairly crude, right? Typically, the FBI would try to get a provocateur. This would usually be somebody posing as an ultra-left. Go into a group and you say, you guys are not radical. You're not being real leftists. You should be out there. And then encouraging these poor dupes to cross the line into some kind of violence, and then they can all be rounded up. Or even just talk on the telephone and tell somebody recording it right at the other end, some agent, oh, my God, we've got this ambitious plan, blah, blah, blah. I'm not going to repeat it, but you get the idea. So that's the old style, right? The idea was to set you up to be arrested. And, of course, this continues, but now laid over that is the new layer of COINTELPRO, which is designed to essentially split groups, to neutralize them, to make people demoralized, to drive them out of politics, to make them think they're going insane, to provoke their suicide in some cases, to essentially make their lives into an inferno of continuous failure and opprobrium, and triumph over them in this way. It is imperative that people understand this. Now, in New York City, right, great capital of leftism, I had a chance to sample quite a number of people about this. And my finding is the following, that COINTELPRO 2.0, COINTELPRO stalking, the modern kind, the Stasi Zersetzung kind, right, decomposition, and above all, the application of 1.0, 2.0 Zersetzung on the social media is not understood. It's not understood. And the problem with it is, one of the giveaways of 2.0 is that it contains plausible deniability. In other words, if they send in a provocateur who proposes violence, well then, you know, that guy can be taped, he can be exposed, you can nail it, right? You can say, this is what they did. But with the modern one, it's got plausible deniability. So often the response is skepticism, sometimes not even expressed. And it's sometimes look at you with glazed eyes and people are thinking, are you really that important? Do they really care that much about you? Why would they pay so much attention to you? Who are you after all? So there's an element of postmodernism in it. Remember, postmodernism generally denies the idea of human greatness or human agency at a high level, right? Agency is reduced to a very low level. To be, you know, if you're a world historical individual, for postmodernism, that's just not possible. There is no such thing. So people have this idea that, there's been a retreat into a very limited conception of the human ego and the human role. And this, I think, people have got to understand, you don't have to be very important anymore. COINTELPRO stalking has been democratized, and it's extended to everybody, no matter how humble. So watch out. Keep your eyes open. Back in a minute. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Here's another note about some of the responses we get now on Facebook, right? The Tarpley Facebook operation is it's extremely lively. We thank people who are expressing their interest. But we're starting to get messages that go like this. Don't you people understand that the Pope is a Jesuit, that therefore you can't trust him, and that the Jesuits are the problem in the world? We get others that say, don't you understand that it's the Israelis or the Jews that are the problem in the world? Or don't you understand that the immigrants are actually the problem? Well, we repudiate all of this. And the thing that is noticed about this is that these things come from very ignorant people who know very little about the story of, say, the Jesuits, right? We put out a statement on there, right? The Jesuits were founded in Rome with the help of Gasparo Contarini, the Venetian intelligence chief. They were big in the Spanish Empire, but they were not as big as you think. The Franciscans, for example, ran Latin America for the Spanish more than the Jesuits. And of course, there's this inconvenient fact that by 1767, the Jesuits had been kicked out of the Portuguese Empire, the French Empire, the Kingdom of the Two Sicilies, Naples and Sicily, Malta, Parma, the Spanish Empire. So that's a good chunk of the world. So how are you going to advance a claim that the Jesuits rule the world today when in 1767 they went into a prolonged eclipse? Now, of course, the Jesuits did turn around and they got their revenge on the Spanish by supporting the British destabilization, right? What goes under Bolivar, San Martin, and O'Higgins and some others, that was done with the help of the British, and the Jesuits joined in. This is not the definitive judgment on those guys, but still, that's what happened. It was the British moving to detach Latin America from the empire of Spain. Right now, the other one is this meeting that the Pope had with the Kentucky County Clerk. I think what that shows is not the ability for intrigue, but it's simply the failure to understand this, right? By all accounts, the interview, it looks like it was a group audience. It was not a general audience with hundreds. It was not a private audience with one or two. It was a group audience. So in comes the county clerk, right? Kim, whatever her name is. and of course, as soon as that's over, her lawyer goes out, Huxterby shows up, and they do a victory lap about how they got in to see the Pope, and very few others did. This is essentially a setup. The Pope was set up by this guy, Vigano. There are people in the Vatican that want this Pope to fail, and the Pope, I think, rather naively, simply said, fine, bring them in and we'll say hello. I'm thinking of Father Lombardi a couple of years ago with Ratzinger. Ratzinger obviously wanted to do an approach to the Islamic world, but he had this unfortunate pedantry where you'll remember Ratzinger said in one of his speeches, 2006, 2007, that he had some Byzantine quote that talked about how violent the Muslim world was. Well, that was enough to set off a worldwide scandal. Father Lombardi was the guy who let him say that nonsense, and that is it's crazy. If he'd still had Navarro Valls, let's say. Navarro Valls was the very intelligent Spanish priest who had been the spokesman for the Vatican before that. He probably would have gotten a warning. Don't say this. So somebody needed to say to Francesco, don't have this woman in there because you're going to make people feel like you tricked them. So he has been set up, and it doesn't prove he's an expert intrigue or anything else. Now, we got people sending us ridiculous, discredited, idiotic, hateful things. They're telling us, oh, we have to read the recommendations of these forged documents, right? The Elders of Zion and other nonsense. So, no, sorry. And then others telling us, oh, it's because of the immigrants, right? The immigrants are polluting our ethnic states. We don't have an ethnic state. I don't want to live in an ethnic state. I want to live in a country based on a constitution which contains ideas of natural law going back to Leibniz, Machiavelli, and John Adams. If you think that Israel runs the United States, how do you explain the fact that the Iran nuclear accord has gone through, despite the 44 seconds of Netanyahu? If you believe that Israel runs the United States, what about President Lieberman? How come the Supreme Court didn't put Gore Lieberman in there and then ease out Gore and then President Lieberman? How do you explain all that? It's just idiotic. And this comes, again, from the most scurrilous, discredited, Confederate, white supremacist and other sources. So, and also, the impudence and the arrogance of these people, talking to somebody like me who's been studying it for 50 years, and they say, Tarpley, you haven't understood. You somehow missed the point here that these groups are responsible. Sorry, don't give me that. That's a bunch of nonsense. And, of course, we're told that that groups have to be scapegoated. I categorically reject the idea that any group can be scapegoated for the depression, except bankers, except zombie bankers and hedge fund hyenas. And those come in all flavors. And their center is the City of London. So you tell me, City of London and Wall Street. So I'm saying this. Stop sending us this stuff. We don't want to read it. We don't have time for it. If you want that, there are plenty of places you can go to get it. Go there. You're not going to hear it here. Now, let's look back at the long view. The interesting thing about the past week is we're seeing the end of this period of unipolar U.S. Domination. It's something that Putin had complained about in the Munich speech of 2007. His speech at the United Nations now was more muted, but it didn't have to be loud because the deeds, right, the presence of the MiG-31s and the base near Latakia, all of that was working for him. Let's just go through this idea of world domination, the idea of a world hegemon, and what has that looked like, right? This concept only came into existence around 1492 or 1494, with the opening of the Atlantic, Columbus, Magellan, Del Cano. It's fashionable today to have a bad view of these people, but they have undoubtedly heroic aspects. They are long-range navigators. They're a part of Renaissance culture. Obviously, you can't blame Columbus for the crimes of the Spanish Empire with slavery and so forth, but the postmodernists have completely lost sight of the heroic aspect of these things. You'll remember that in 1494, just as the French were invading Italy and threatening the Vatican, Pope Alexander VI Borgia did the papal line of demarcation. That was later codified in the Treaty of Tordesillas between Spain and Portugal, so they divided the world between them, just as Charles VIII of France was invading Italy. So that started the series, and this is the 1494, the French in Italy. That's the big event in Machiavelli's life. He says, I never would have believed that the French could have conquered Italy with chalk alone, marking the doors of the buildings they wanted to seize with no resistance until he turned around and started to go home. So this opens the thing of the great fight between France and Spain over Italy, Charles V of Habsburg on the Spanish and Austrian side, and Francis I, François Premier of France on the French side. Now, the outcome of that is a series of Italian wars that lead up until 1530. 1530 marks the beginning of Spanish world domination. 1530 to 1659, Spain, generally speaking, dominates the world, and we'll tell you how in our final segment. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. We are now going to put the transition from the unipolar world of 1990 to 2015, the past quarter century, marked by the attempt at unipolar domination by the United States, which has been wrecked in the only way it could have been wrecked, from within, by neocon fascist madmen, neocon warmongers, joined by humanitarian bombers of the Samantha Power stripe. The end of the Italian wars marks the beginning of a period of Spanish world domination. It starts under the Emperor Charles V. He is soon, or relatively soon, by about the middle of the century, he's replaced by Philip II. And by 1580 or so, we have the merger of the Portuguese world empire and the Spanish world empire, both then ruled by Philip II from the Escurial near Madrid. This world domination goes on, as I say, from 1530 to 1659. It is the Spanish who dominate the world ocean. Of course, they have competition from the Dutch and the English. And they, of course, they undergo serious problems, right? We have the fact that the English send troops into the Netherlands to fight the Spanish. These are those wars where Sir Philip Sidney was killed, right? Famous Englishman, poet. And we've also got the Invincible Armada of 1588, which turns out not to be invincible. So the Spanish have to absorb very significant defeats, and their empire is soon in decline, but it hangs on for a very long time. The advisor to Charles V, who got this all going, is Gattinara, an Italian advisor. And his slogan was Dominium Mundi, world domination. First unite the Christian world and then dominate and rule the entire world. So world domination, the program of Charles V and then Philip II. So Gattinara is the idea man, along with a couple of others. But the idea is that once you try to have universal monarchy or world domination, you're going to call into existence a coalition of other states to try to cut the hegemon down to size. And as it turned out, this role fell to Cardinal Richelieu of France. So Richelieu is the first guy to say, let's not have Spanish world domination. Richelieu sets up an alliance with France and the Netherlands, and Sweden was a great power under Gustavus Adolphus. They were able to penetrate practically down to the Alps. So this is now in the 30 Years' War, 1618 to 1648. This war actually went on until the Peace of the Pyrenees between France and Spain, 1659. So the Spanish and the French keep fighting. For 11 years after the Treaty of Westphalia ends the big 30 Years' War, there's still a kind of a significant part of the 30 Years' War that goes on for another 10 years. And the idea here is to avoid the universal monarchy of Spain, the Spanish create a group of people, or bring forth a group of people, who I think you can call neocons. And I write about this in my book, Paolo Sarpi, His Networks, Venice, and the Coming of the 30 Years' War. I see that significant parts of that are online. Nothing I guess I can do about that. But it's people like Olivares, Bedmar, Osuna, Gondomar, Zuniga, Villafranca, Oñate. That's a group of Spanish neocons who essentially say we gotta maintain the empire with constant war. And in the meantime, the entire textile system, the sheep, the wool, the looms, everything else is collapsing at home. So the French take over. Now, the French, this is now the era of Louis XIV. So Louis XIV, the Sun King, is the dominant guy in Europe and worldwide, I think we can say, from 1659 to 1714. So it's from the end of that extended 30 Years' War to the end of the War of the Spanish Succession. And in the case of the War of the Spanish Succession, this is William III of England, William and Mary, who puts together this grand alliance against the Sun King. So again, a coalition of other states. So England, the Netherlands, Austria, get together against the Sun King. It includes, you know, the takeover of England in 1688 by William and Mary, all kinds of stuff. France and Spain stay together. They try to carry out the unification of those two monarchies, right? The idea was the Pyrenees exist no longer, but it doesn't work. And by 1714, the big winners are the British. So we then have a very long period, all the way up to 1943. So from 1714 to 1942-43, or thereabouts, the British tend to dominate the world. And after Trafalgar, right, the naval defeat of Napoleon, they have about a century of, very marked, practically multipolar, but not quite, world domination. So that ends really in the Second World War. Purists may say there's a period in the middle of the Second World War where Nazi Germany may have gotten to world domination. We don't need to get into that finer detail. But from 1943 to 1990, you've got the relative domination of the U.S., but of course a strong Soviet Union with the Warsaw Pact and a powerful coalition of states. So it's not really a unipolar world, although there is the hegemony tendency of the United States. And then we get down to the collapse of the Soviet Empire, which was a disaster, didn't have to happen. You could have kept it together, let the Baltics go, let some people, let Georgia go if they want to go, a few others. But other than that, you could have kept it with Ukraine and Belarus and Central Asia. But no, the push from the CIA and from Washington and so forth, this was very strong. So a period from 1990 to 2015 of really unipolar U.S. world domination. It has been poorly administered. If you wanted to keep that, you should have made that into a golden age. And needless to say, this was not what the neocons had in mind. Look at how they wasted all these advantages, deindustrializing the U.S., attacking Iraq in 1991, then again in 2003. This entire 9/11 exercise used then as a pretext for the Afghan war, constant meddling, the bombing of Libya, the meddling in Syria, the color revolutions. It's all terrible, terrible administration. We can thank the neocons for whatever bad events go with this transition. But if we get rid of the neocons, the events really don't have to be bad. What we're looking at, as I've tried to point out, we should actively seek a condominium with Russia, a two-party world domination or administration, with the British and the French being brought along by the U.S. in the Security Council and China being persuaded to join in by Russia. With this, we could dictate an end to the war in Syria. We could dictate a solution to the Ukrainian situation, which would essentially be conforming with the issues, the interests of Russia and the United States, if reasonably understood, not by neocons, but by actual classical Americans, we could say, here. We would have no problem getting along with Russia. Same thing for the Middle East, right? The two-state solution imposed from the outside, because the world is now tired of the menace of Third World War coming out of this, left to politicians who simply...
Okay.